The task of feeding a hungry planet, despite the fact that it's a universal concern, has become a polarizing issue, with industrial agriculture on one side and small organic farmers on the other. There's an urgent need to resolve their differences, as the recent spate of natural disasters has reminded us. Advocates of scientific agriculture argue that it's necessary to keep up with the sheer scale of human needs. Opponents question its safety. The arguments pro and con are familiar to Dr. John Purcell, Vice President of Global Research and Development at Monsanto, and we're asking him to share his perspective. Good morning, John. Thanks for coming in.
Chris, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
What's the case for applying science to large-scale agriculture?
Well, I'd argue there's a case for applying science to all-scale agriculture. I mean, I think
good point.
One of the things
hard to separate from agriculture.
Well, it is. And as a seed company, I mean, I've got customers with thousands of acres in California or Brazil or Europe, and I've got customers right here in Hawaii with 10 acres, 100% organic. Mm-hmm. And I think science for me as a scientist, of course, it's about really about delivering innovations in the marketplace. It's really about allowing our customers and our farmers to be successful, because they're doing a job that's obviously so critical, increasing populations, you know, higher input costs, reduction in land. We've got to have innovation in order to drive that, whether you be a small grower, organic grower, or whether you be a large-scale conventional grower or anything in between.
John, as soon as I say the word Monsanto, there's a reaction in a place like Hawaii in particular. To what do you attribute that?
I think it's pretty complex, and I had the pleasure, Chris, of living here for a few years, and you know, just amazing, wonderful, wonderful people. I think it goes pretty deep. I also had the pleasure of heading up Monsanto's research operations in Europe, mm-hmm. and again, some deep-seated feelings about Monsanto. And I think first thing is we got to recognize the real. We got to recognize that we have an obligation to address it. I think for a lot of years, we spent time talking with our customers, which are growers and farmers, talking to the food chain, talking to people that are in agriculture. But we missed the 98%, 98 point plus whatever percent of people who aren't in agriculture but are talking about food and have concerns about safety, have concerns about where their food comes from, have ideas about a better way of growing things. And frankly, it wasn't until 3 or 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, we said, look, this is ridiculous. Everybody's talking about us. We need to be in the conversation.
Yeah.
And I think it's been really positive. I do a lot of events. Some of them, frankly, aren't that friendly, but you score points just for showing up, right? And just
sure.
to say, look, let us talk to you about what we do as a company. Let us talk to you about agriculture. And I think for us in Hawaii, a big part of it was just pulling back the curtains and saying, here's what happens on our farm. You know, having open houses, having tours, going out into community, giving talks at, you know, local clubs at, you know, different citizen clubs, et cetera. And it's really opened up a lot of conversations for us that have been really, really important. Because what I think you find is once you get in a conversation, we had an event last night, a network event at the site on Kania, 100-plus people there. You find their shared values. You know, when we talk about how we think about using drip irrigation to save water, how we think about some of our soil conservation programs, how we think about controlling pests using modern tools, really tools that have a long basis in science, like integrated pest management. You find values that you share with people, and they may not know a lot about Monsanto, or they may have certain ideas about Monsanto, but then when you're talking about soil and water and better ways to control pests, you find, oh my gosh, we have something in common. And we actually opened up a STEM education center last night. We had a number of educators there that we're going to make available to schools on Hawaii who doesn't share a value around education. And
yeah.
So that's been the good part about it is, you know, we recognize we had to do a better job. We had to address the concerns in the community. And a big part of it is just pulling back the curtains, inviting people in and find places where you can share some values, whether it be education, whether it be sustainability, whether it be butterflies. You work with the Wahoo Butterfly Club
yeah.
because we have a program there for monarch butterflies on our farm. Once you find a point of shared values, then you can have a real conversation about food and about agriculture, and then you get over kind of some of the noise that's out there and allows you to have what I call a real conversation about food and agriculture.
Well, the conversation has to center on the future, and there's a lot of hungry people out there.
Yeah.
And as how much trouble, if the world goes on the way it is now, how much trouble are we in?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's scary, and as all of us in agriculture, we take the global situation very, very seriously. You know, when you live in the U.S., you live in Western Europe, we're in a pretty fortunate situation. Not everyone, but, you know, people are generally fed. We have a lot of choices in our grocery stores. We're able to afford a lot of things we want. Now, we have certainly people that need help as far as meeting their basic needs. But on a global scale, there's still over 800 million people that the U.N. Designates as undernourished or you know,
starving.
That don't have enough food. And that's an outrageous high number. The good news is over the last 30 years, actually the number of people have gone down. Although last year, and this is scary, first time in 10 years, the number ticked up. You know, and that's not a good proposition. But because of raised awareness, some of its distribution, but frankly, some of its technology, it's really about innovation providing higher yields with reduced inputs. It's allowing us to grow more with less. And so we've been making progress to it, but still that 800 plus million people in this or on this world that are not getting the calories they need. And even in the U.S., there's lots of communities where people are making a choice. Do I pay an electric bill or do I get some food, right? I mean, this is basic kind of stuff that we've got to be. And sometimes we get in this bubble around what we want food to be, but we got to recognize there's a basic need here for calories and for production agriculture to provide food for a lot of people on this earth. And 2 billion more coming, Chris, which is the other pressure point, right?
So, John, a problem of that scale usually requires a change in consciousness, a real tectonic shift in how things are done, because I suspect the way we're producing food now is not adequate to feed the number of people that we're going to have on the planet.
Yeah, and some estimates
are.
We're going to need actually, because not just the amount of food that needs to be produced, but because the types of food. You know, as economies evolve, as economies mature, the types of food they ingest actually change. So some estimates say by 2050 we're going to need 50% more food, and we're not getting more land. We're not getting more farmers. So it really cries for we're going to need some pretty broad-scale innovations to continue to keep up. As I say, we've made progress over the last 20, 30 years. And as you mentioned in your opening comments, I've been on farms in over 35 countries now. And I tell you, the dedication is there at the farmer level, but they've got to have the tools. They've got to have the innovation. They've got to have the ability to take advantage of technologies. And it's going to require not just where we're in, which is the seed business and the agricultural input business, but it's going to require the whole chain to look at this, because some of it is better storage of food. You know, in the developing world, a lot of stuff rots on the vine. They can't, because there's not enough storage capacity, or the distribution channels are so bad. Transportation in some of these countries. So
is that sort of an under-recognized issue?
I think, and I think, of course, the dichotomy is, right, we got obesity rising in many parts of the world, and then in other parts of the world, we've got more people starving. So you've got this dichotomy. Distribution is a part of it. Part of it is storage, part of it. But, you know, I think one of the things we try to do is think about in our business, what can we do? Well, what if we had, as we've launched in India, a tomato that stores better or a tomato that can be shipped better? That has huge value, because now you're not trying to get it to market in 2 days. You have 3 or 4 or 5 days. And the infrastructure can support that. And I think it's those kinds of things that seem small as far as innovation goes, but can have a huge impact. And it's going to require all parts of the chain, all the way from the grower, all the way out to the final selling point to the consumer, to think about their processes, think about what innovations they can bring, and then let's address it to both in the developing world and the developed world.
Well, I know innovations are hard to predict. That's why they call them innovations, right? But at the same time, you began to allude to that. I'm just wondering, in what areas are the most productive areas where innovation can make a difference? You mentioned distribution.
Yeah. And I think part of it is what's really cool, Chris. And this is, I mean, I'm a half glass full person. In agriculture and in science, you better be optimistic, because you're going to face a lot of things out there, right? But a lot of hurdles. But I think what's cool about it, over the last 20, 30 years, I'd call it the age of biology. I mean, you can think about it in the human, on a human health perspective, how much genomics has really changed the world. Well, in agriculture, the same way. It's the understanding at a basic level. And it's not just GMOs. That's one tool. But it's really about better understanding at the genetic level. Why do plants perform a certain way? How do they produce their fruit? What are the genetics of that we can modify? Or or that we can understand so that we can drive new innovations. In some cases, it's modification. In other cases, it's just doing better selections, better breeding, because we understand the genetics very well. And in vegetables, that's where predominantly the products come from, is that advanced breeding. But it's been sort of the golden age of biology because of the investments in genomics, genetics, really understanding at more of a molecular level why plants perform the way they do. What's coming, though, what's really exciting is what we've seen over the last 3, 4, 5, 6 years is an infusion of digital and robotics and all of these new confluence of technologies that will have tremendous impact. You know, I always laugh about it. I say, it ain't your granddad's farm anymore. Ain't your granddad's tractor anymore. When you're plugging a tablet in with a script that tells the tractor when to plant, where to plant, how to plant, when it's monitoring the soil, monitoring the moisture contents, monitoring weather climatic conditions, and then taking all that data to allow the farmer to make better decisions about when they plant, how they manage their crop, when they harvest. That's a whole new age. And then on the, you know, on the side of the after harvest, you know, all the tools that are happening there for even as you harvest, how do you use new robotics, automation, mechanization? So it's really cool. You know, it used to be you'd show up at these meetings, it'd be a lot of agricultural people at these, but now you've got startups, you've got venture capitalists, you've got all these new technologies flowing in here trying to address the most basic challenge of all, which is how do we produce enough food to feed the world. And it's really cool to see. And the other thing is it's attracting a whole new crowd. I mean, I'll be 60 next year. I'm not going to be around forever, right? But it's like you're attracting a whole new generation of people who are really have this as a real passion for them. And they're coming in from IT, from mathematics, from robotics, all these cool things, and now applying it to how we produce our food. And that's a really cool age to be a part of agriculture.
Let's hope that coming together trend continues. That'd be probably a lot of people would benefit, John.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much for coming in.
I appreciate it.
Dr. John Purcell is the Vice President of Global Research and Development at Monsanto.
Tourism powers Hawaii's economy. Visitors spend $43 million every day. Last year, that meant nearly $2 billion in state tax revenue and nearly 200,000 jobs. But along with the benefits come some costs. Join us all week for Traveling Money, Managing Hawaii's Tourism Future on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and The Conversation. Listen for your chance to call in live and join the conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the Icelandic perspective on global tourism. But first, your quiz. You just heard us in conversation with Monsanto's head of global research and development. And although the subject of genetically modified organisms often causes passions to flare in Hawaii, there's one case involving GMOs that's frequently held up as a success story. In the 1990s, Hawaii's papaya industry was in a state of panic. The ring spot virus was ravaging crops across Hawaii Island, where the vast majority of the state's papayas are grown. Much in the same manner as Ireland's 19th century potato blight, thousands of Kapoho Solo papaya trees began to die. To put the die-off in perspective, the papaya yield in 1984 was over 80 million pounds. In 2010, only 30 million were harvested. Many experts believe that Hawaii's papaya could have been completely wiped out if not for the discovery made by a Kohala-born scientist who found a way to save the papaya from the ring spot virus. Today, we're looking for his name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Eric Johnson from Honolulu Theater for Youth. If you like today's music, find the playlist at The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Iceland and Hawaii have more in common as visitor destinations than you might imagine. Volcanic islands, whose drawing card is their natural beauty, facing the challenges that accompany a robust visitor industry. Olaf Atladóttir is the Director General of the Icelandic Tourist Board, Vice President of the European Travel Commission. She's in town to deliver the keynote address at the 2017 Global Tourism Summit. And we asked her how a visitor destination can keep itself on a path to continued growth.
Destinations, they need to define, both on a national and a regional basis, they need to define what their area stands for. What are the area's characteristics? Mm-hmm. What sets it apart from other areas? And mainly they have to reach into the heart and soul of the area itself and the people that live there to define what the offer is that they want to offer. I think that maybe until the last decade, many destinations, and perhaps Iceland among them, mm-hmm. was very busy in getting themselves known, out
sure.
there. So they were very busy defining what the visitors would want, mm-hmm. without maybe thinking enough about, what the destination itself would be comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is maybe a pivotal moment for tourism when people start realizing that. And that is something that we are realizing around the world, and sometimes painfully in destinations. As for example, the residents protest or you get a backlash, environmental backlash or something.
Yeah.
So I think it's really important that you base your niche group or the people that you are inviting, because you're always inviting people to your country,
mm-hmm.
and you base it on real characteristics, and you also set some rules about the responsible behavior of your visitors, because they have to abide by them also.
Mm-hmm. It sounds as if you've paid a great deal of attention in your country to what makes you unique.
Well, in my country, we are fortunate in that it's pretty easy to define, because we are, like Hawaii, we are an island in the middle of an ocean. We are, very fortunate with our geology, since we are on the top of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. We are a young island geologically, which means that we are sharp.
Mm-hmm.
We have sharp mountains. We have, big waterfalls. We have glaciers. We have geysers. We have volcanoes that erupt every 3 years or so,
mm-hmm.
3 or 4 years. And so it doesn't, for us, it's not maybe so difficult to define that from a natural point of view. And Iceland is a nature destination. However, I think that, for example, if we go down to the regions of Iceland, because tourism can be a really, really beneficial economic activity for rural regions, for example, around Iceland, and a big boost to the economy, and not least a boost to the people that want to live there and maybe need more of an economic incentive to be able to do so. And these regions have often sat down and defined themselves, trying to figure out what are their specific characteristics, what sets them apart from other regions
mm-hmm.
in Iceland. And I think that is the interesting development that we've been seeing for the past, as I say, past decade or so.
Far greater attention to the specifics of a region,
yes,
rather than just sort of saying, come and go on vacation here.
Yeah, because I think that destination, because one of the things that we're seeing around the world is that people travel.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem that you need to try and get people to travel, as it was maybe in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So you can sort of define yourself from from your own characteristics, as I say, and you can go down into regional aspects of that, and even into small regions. I mean, in Iceland, we have a very small region that is focusing a lot on backcountry skiing, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And this would perhaps not have been possible 10 years ago before this big surge in international travel. So I think this gives us opportunities, but of course it gives us challenges too.
We're seeing a whole different kind of international travel, it would seem, in recent decades, where people are much more interested in the local culture than they used to be. We've seen that in Hawaii, certainly. True in your country as well?
Yes, and I think it comes with, because traveling for pleasure is not perhaps such an old thing. You know, it's not very many generations that have, in general, been able to travel for pleasure. It was sort of the aristocracy in Europe,
sure,
in the 19th century.
The Grand Tour.
Yes, the Grand Tour. And maybe it's, you know, it's become more easy and easier and easier. So now we're seeing a generation, perhaps my generation, and definitely the younger people,
mm-hmm,
who look upon travel as just a part of their life's quality. And they're seasoned travelers. They're knowledgeable. They know what they want. And one of the things that they want is to be able to get to know the people in the destination, because perhaps the people that live there are tourism's greatest resource.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously, even though it's interesting to see beautiful places, you're always visiting somebody's home. And I think that the seasoned traveler, the person that sort of knows about traveling and knows how to behave responsibly also,
mm-hmm,
that is what they're looking for. It's this immersion, or at least, even though it's maybe a bit of a faux immersion, but it's, you know, having this feeling of being in real contact with other people and seeing how they live.
The kind of traveler that you're describing now doesn't necessarily want to go to a full-service resort where they are pampered 24 hours a day and, in a way, are cut off from the country around them. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I think that these groups that I was describing, yes, I think that that is maybe true in general.
Mm-hmm.
However, I also think, and this I base upon both my own experiences as a traveler and also what I see around, you know, in Iceland, where we have the rugged highlands, where you go into the highlands, you spend time there, and there's, you know, there are not a lot of services there. So I think the pampering part is always sort of maybe in the back of the mind of, mm-hmm, of a lot of people, and certainly for me, you know, after
sure,
you know, spending a lot of time being a bit dirty in the highlands,
mm-hmm,
it's really good to be able to go pamper yourself somewhere. But however, I think that people that are interested in other people in other countries' cultures, I think that these closed off resorts, I think that they maybe hold lesser part of interest for them.
To say the adventure traveler, the so-called eco-tourist?
Yeah, but I think that, you know, we've played so loose and fast with the term eco-tourism that I don't really like to use that term,
uh-huh, uh-huh,
you know. But yes, maybe the adventure traveler, even though that's defined very widely also.
Sure.
But I think it's basically this seasoned traveler, you know, whose trip it isn't the first, who has often built a knowledgeable background for his or her travels, and as I say, who's interested in other people, you know, and the way that they live, and also interested in learning. So maybe you could call it an edu-traveler, you know, because they want to learn. They both want to learn cultural history and natural history. So I think that's maybe often a more apt term. And they want to behave responsibly. So there you would get the eco part of that in.
It's a very different kind of traveler from the I just want to relax and let the cares drift away. You actually want to do something. You want to really fill your time.
Well, I think these travelers also, as I say, want to relax. They want to mix it up a bit,
yeah,
often. You know, they want to maybe have a you know, very fulfilling experience, and then also maybe be able to relax at the end of the day or at the end of their trip or something. So I don't think anything is really cut and dried. I think all people fall into a lot of categories. Maybe it's just like a ruling slide where you have,
uh-huh,
at one end you have this perfect adventure, edu, eco, whatever, traveler, and on the other, the people that just want to lie on a beach and drink beer. And most people fall somewhere on that slide, you know. And I think that is the interesting part about travel.
Olaf Atladóttir of the Icelandic Tourist Board is in Honolulu to deliver the keynote address at the 2017 Global Tourism Summit, Thursday at 9:30 at the Hawaii Convention Center. Her topic, Responsible Tourism, will emphasize the importance of a holistic approach to tourism.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, U.S. farmers up against it from shifting trade policies to a changing climate. We'll look at the state of the U.S. farmer now. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2, following the world.
You can get dizzy trying to keep track of the various cost estimates we've heard down through the years for the Honolulu Rail Project. They're usually accompanied by verification of some kind, so how can two separate estimates of the project's cost be $1 billion apart? That's well beyond any reasonable margin of error, so what exactly is going on? The Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation's figures are well below the mayor's, and Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton has been looking into the discrepancy in today's reality check. Good morning, Stuart.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Not too bad. Not too bad. I was kind of thinking of all the numbers that we'd heard over the years and how widely they have varied. And each time we get a number, we're told that, you know, this is pretty close. We've put a lot of work into putting this estimate together. So how can two estimates at the same time of the project at the same stage be so different?
Well, what we're looking at is what we're looking at now that came out yesterday is the long-awaited recovery plan from HART. This is the plan that's going to tell the Federal Transit Administration how HART is going to finish building the rail project.
Mm-hmm.
So the plan included a financial plan, which was, again, it came out of the special session that we just finished.
Right.
And the special session basically said, this is how we're going to pay for rail. Now, how we're going to pay for it is key. What tax revenue we're going to use. And here's where the big difference is. Now, mm-hmm. remember, we in the media and a lot of people were using the $10 billion number, and we were saying $10 billion, including financing costs. What are financing costs? That's basically interest.
Right.
Why was the interest so high? The answer is that the idea, the original plan, and it seemed like the one that at least was the default plan, was to rely on an extension of the general excise tax. The extension would begin in 2027 and go out for 10 years. But one idea would go out indefinitely. But whatever the case is, that money doesn't kick in until 2027. The problem is you need the money now. So how is HART going to do that? They're going to borrow the money now and then start paying it off or pay it off later with interest. The big difference, or a big difference, was the interest.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of this that the legislature came up with was, hey, instead of pushing everything back and waiting, we're going to front load it. We're going to get a new tax, this hotel room tax, the TAT. It's a 1 percentage point increase in the hotel room tax statewide. We'll start getting money now, and we don't have to pay as much interest. And that seems to be a big reason for the difference.
That's
now,
that's where the difference is coming in interest. It's
one of them. There are other things as well. I think there was a certain amount of sort of estimating going on and saying, well, it's about $9.5 billion or 9 point something billion, so we'll round it up to $10 billion. But yeah, one of the big differences, and it seems like a major difference, is this cost savings from front loading.
Front loading being the rationale for the transit accommodation tax, because we get more money
exactly. Now.
We can spend it now. We don't have to borrow it. The estimates of the total interest paid as part of that whole project are pretty huge, aren't they?
Yeah, it's still a lot. I mean, we're still talking about, even under this new plan, we're still talking about $858 million in interest payments. So it's still a lot. It's just less than what they thought before.
Long ago, Illinois senator said a million here, a million there. Pretty soon you're talking about a lot of money. That would seem to apply here.
Yeah, that's right. But again, let's see if we can hold them to this $9 billion price tag instead of $10 billion. It is a billion-dollar difference, but it's still a lot of money. And remember, bear in mind, when they first entered the contract with the FTA, we were talking about $5 billion. So we're still talking about maybe 60% more than the original estimate. So it's hardly a bargain.
Pretty soon you're talking about real money, Stuart. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Chris.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Stuart Yurton. Most of us have a gap in our educational background, one that has cost some of us a great deal. So-called financial literacy, basic training in handling money and avoiding the many pitfalls attendant on failing to understand how financial systems work. Denise Esposito is executive director for the Hawaii Council on Economic Education, whose mission it is to promote and improve the teaching of economics in Hawaii's public and private schools. When we spoke the other day, she said that she, like many, grew up with gaps in her financial literacy.
I think the one thing that I didn't learn when I was younger is credit card percentage rates, how much interest they charge you.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that if you have $2,000 in credit card debt and $5,000 in the bank, you should use that money to pay off the credit card debt.
Yeah.
And these are the kinds of things that we want to teach teachers and
students.
And that
a $2,000 credit card debt can eat up, you know, more than twice that sum, right?
That's correct.
If you take long enough.
Yep.
It took a long time to get the, you know, now with the credit card report, you get this thing of if you pay it at the asked for rate, it'll take you this long to pay it off. But it took a long time, and probably I would suspect quite a bit of lobbying and resistance to get that on your credit card report, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It took a lot of lobbying, a lot of time, yeah.
What's the what's behind the effort to promote financial literacy? How did that – is that a grassroots effort?
There's actually a national organization, the National Council on Economic Education, and every state has its affiliate council, mm-hmm. and they promote financial literacy and economics in the schools by holding workshops for teachers and programs for students. So.
What are the kind of things, you know, when you walk into class on that first day, what are the kind of things that the teachers tell you to kind of set the stage?
Budgeting, saving. So budgeting first, because mm-hmm. that's, you know, where the money is coming from and where it's going.
Right.
And then if there's any leftover money, savings, investing. Mm-hmm. And so those are the steps that we kind of go through as far as financial literacy and
budgeting, savings before investing.
Yes. That's
correct. I would think the order at which these things were taught would be extremely important.
Yes. Because a lot of people now don't have enough savings to really start investing, so you have to teach people how to budget.
Yeah.
That's your first step, I think, in personal finance.
And then, of course, investing. Now we're getting into the area of risk.
Yes.
And understanding risk.
And long-term investing, too. Realizing that you're not going to be buying and selling stocks. You're going to let them sit there for years and years and years, and then at the end you'll have this nice retirement income, hopefully.
If you pick the right stock.
That's correct, yeah.
But, you know, then how do you sort of, I mean, it's a form of gambling, which requires a certain amount of temperament, you know, to calm yourself down during the tough times when that stock goes down. Mm-hmm. How do you convey that kind of state of mind?
Well, you know, I remember in 2008 looking at our retirement accounts and how they were hit so badly by what happened in 2008. And my husband very wisely said, you just have to wait it out. It's going to eventually come back. Mm-hmm. And it did. And we see that today where the markets have all come back very nicely. And we, the money that we had lost, we've made back since 2008. So I think you just have to be – put your emotions aside and be logical and just stay the course, I think.
You know, these things that come under the banner of financial literacy are so fundamental to having any kind of a livable life. And yet – it really is, when you think about it, remarkable that none of us had any training on this.
And that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to instill in teachers to take financial literacy and economics and put them into every single class that you teach, because everything is economics, scarcity, demand, things like that.
So yeah, as opposed to a separate class, mm-hmm. you integrating the whole notion of financial literacy into, say, history class, current affairs, that kind of
thing. Yes, yes, just like that. We really are into the concept of integrating rather than a separate class.
Yeah. Well, say, how would you integrate it into a history class, for example?
You could just look at the economics, let's say, of wartime.
Mm-hmm.
You could look at World War II, World War I, and see how the economy was affected by war. Mm-hmm. And that's very, very – I mean, what happens is the economy is actually stimulated when there's war.
Yeah.
So
industries
mm-hmm.
or factories are working around the clock and
yes.
things,
yes.
which is one of the more counterintuitive things about war, because when a lot of the prosperity in America of the 1950s was attributed to the Second World War.
That's true. That's true.
When you teach that, do people understand it? Were they aware of it?
I think so. I think when you're in the middle of a war like that, though, you're not really aware of how the economics are working. I think it's something that you look back on and analyze. Yeah.
Well, economics has been traditionally seen as hard to teach, you know, the dismal science and all that kind of thing. So how would you, in a teaching capacity, sort of say, in effect, you know, this is a subject that's frequently thought of as a little on the dull side, but it's pretty important. How do you sell that?
You can really jazz up economics.
You
can make it a lot of fun. I know some teachers, there's a lot of university professors out there that do things like Shark Tank for the entrepreneur side of finance. Or they do videos where students compete in creating videos that talk about economic theory, but they're fun videos. And they take lyrics from songs and change it into an economic bent. So there's a lot of really creative things out there that teachers are doing. And that's what we're trying to do here. Is even in Hawaii, there's a lot of creative teaching that's going on. And that's why we award a Teacher of the Year and a School of the Year every mm-hmm. year for this innovative economic
curriculum. For kind of being able to bring financial literacy into the classroom?
Yes.
Well, because when you think about economics, it's seen as not very exciting. But if you're either making or losing a lot of money, that's pretty exciting.
It's pretty exciting.
You get pretty,
not the losing part.
No, well, I mean, that's exciting in a in a negative way,
in a negative
right?
way,
but,
yes.
But at the same time, so that – I guess if you bring the whole issue down to how it's going to affect you, the student's life, that's the way to sort of bring them into this, isn't it?
And one area that I think is really important now is, especially in high school, is to teach students how to budget and how to save, and then teach them about debt, especially when it comes to financing your college education.
Denise Esposito is Executive Director for the Hawaii Council on Economic Education. Its mission is to promote and improve the teaching of economics in Hawaii's public and private schools and increase the economic and financial literacy of Hawaii's students and residents. HCEE will be holding its annual awards dinner on September 21st at the Hilton Hawaiian Village in Honolulu to celebrate champions in economic education.
Aloha, I'm Ruth Fletcher from St. Andrew's Schools. We represent the Priory, the Prep, and Queen Emma Preschool. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to name the Hawaii-born scientist who helped save Hawaii's papaya industry in the 1990s. Our mystery scientist was born in Kohala and attended the University of Hawaii at Hilo in the 60s. His goal was to secure a supervisor position at one of the sugar companies. Instead, he became a plant pathologist at Cornell University in New York State. But fate would bring him back to Hawaii when the ring spot virus appeared in Puna and ravaged Hawaii Island's papaya farms. When that happened in 1992, the Kapoho Solo papaya was the sole variety being grown in Hawaii, and it proved extremely vulnerable to the virus. Through genetic modification, a new variety was developed, the so-called rainbow papaya, that was resistant to ring spot. The rainbow papaya now makes up close to 80% of Hawaii's papaya crop and is largely credited with saving the industry. And the work of Kohala-born scientist Dennis Gonsalves was crucial to that effort. This was quite a popular quiz, but Janet from Maui was the first to get the answer right. So she's our today's quiz winner. And that's our quiz for today. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Hawaii is the home of big wave surfing, known around the world for legendary breaks like Waimea Bay on Oahu and Jaws on Maui. It's an extreme sport that has been a male domain until now. Contest co-director Rena Delgado and her team want to change all that. They're in the process of putting together the inaugural Women's Waimea Bay Championship for the fast-approaching big wave season on the North Shore, and she's with us by phone. Hi, Rena. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
This is a fairly ambitious goal that you folks have. How long have you been working on it?
Well, Betty DiPolito is the contest director, and she and I have been working together for 2 years now. But Betty herself has been working on this for the past 8 years, and we just got the permit back in the beginning of August of this year.
So what's your next step?
Well, the permit being given to us only 2 months in advance kind of created an exciting challenge, so to speak. We have to find sponsors to, fund the event, and we're having kind of a little bit of difficulty just because it's so late in the game at this moment, but hopefully have a little bit of luck coming soon. And for the most part, we just have to organize, get all the girls together, and wait for the swell to come in.
How many contestants do you expect to have?
Well, we're expecting as many as 26. There have been girls from all over the world kind of emailing in and contacting us wanting to be in the contest. But definitely some standouts like locals like Emily Erickson and Makani Audrick, girls from South and Central America like Polly Ralda and Nicole Pacelli, and of course the Outer Island girls, Keala Kennelly, Andrea Moeller, and Paige Elms are just all excited, thrilled, and ready to make history.
Well, is there a feeling that this is something whose time has come? I mean, you folks have been surfing bigger waves for a while now, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big wave surfer. I've been surfing out on the North Shore, big waves Waimea and the Outer Reefs for maybe the past 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
But women have been doing it far longer than that, and there are just more of us now. So it's kind of like we can't be ignored anymore, and we're just so excited and honestly honored to be creating this event at Waimea Bay. It's where my passion was born for big waves, and I know many others, men and women, and I don't know, it's a special place, and to be doing a contest there, an event there, it's amazing.
Well, one of the challenges of putting together an event of this kind, Rena, is predicting when you're going to get the kind of waves and what you need, and what are the kind of waves you need?
And that is a big wave surfer's dilemma, always waiting for the big waves to come in.
Yeah.
We will be looking for as good as swell conditions as possible. Our waiting period is October 1st to November 21st. So we're hoping for a 20-foot swell. That means 40-foot faces. So pretty big out there.
Well, you know, how do you notify contestants to get there in time? This is the problem they face with the Eddie Icaro, right?
Yes, some people come in like the day before for that. So we're hoping to at least be able to predict the swell coming in at least a week in advance, and then maybe 3 to 4 days actually notifying the contestants to, you know, head over if they're coming over from the mainland or from elsewhere. And then, of course, the day before, we'll make the public announcement that the contest will be the next day.
How do you then judge, what are criteria for success in a contest like this?
Well, of course, the biggest wave, you know, is going to get the most points, but also commitment, you know, strategy, like where are you sitting out in the lineup, how deep are you taking off, and of course, if you complete the wave versus just, you know, dropping in and going straight or falling.
Mm-hmm.
So there's quite a few factors. But, of course, you know, the biggest wave is going to get the most attention and the most points. And as well as, like, skill. You know, how well are you riding the wave? And do you make it all the way to the channel?
How do you train for an event like this, Rena?
Well, I personally like to just have fun and do a little bit of everything. You know, ocean swimming, breath training, weightlifting, all of that. You really have to take a holistic approach. And, you know, there's girls out there who dedicate their lives to this, and they're prepared, you know, year-round to surf big waves all over the world. I would say breath training and spending as much time in the ocean is the best way to train for big waves.
How do you do breath training?
Well, breath training is more of a mental thing than a physical thing. Of course, you have to, you know, get your body ready and your cardiovascular system ready, but it's really just a mental thing of understanding your body and knowing that you can go long periods of time without oxygen. And just that kind of mental staying calm, collecting yourself, and just knowing that you'll make it through, you'll make it back to the surface.
Because you, if you're going to surf big waves, you've got to deal with the possibility that you're going to involuntarily be underwater for a while, right?
Absolutely. You have to be prepared for that because it's going to happen eventually. And, you know, it can be really scarring if you have a bad experience, and it can ruin this beautiful sport. So, you know, you have to be prepared, and you can do things like rock running at Waimea, you know, grabbing onto a rock and running underwater, or even going to a class. They offer them like on Maui and Big Island, and, you know, they take them down to pretty deep depths and they hold their breath, so it's pretty incredible.
Well, we'll hold our breath until you get this contest off the ground, Rena.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Sounds good.
Rena Delgado is contest co-director for the inaugural Women's Waimea Bay Championship. Dates to be announced. You can get details on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Hi, this is Ira Flatow. More than ever, we need science, and not just on Friday. HPR brings you great science journalism and just plain great journalism every day. Make an investment now in news you can count on. Please give as generously as you can, and it's easy, at hawaiipublicradio.org. Or call during business hours, and you can talk to a real human being. 808-955-8821. We're counting on you.
Guten Tag, dies ist Markus Wessendorf. Sollten Sie einen Beitrag dieser Sendung noch einmal hören wollen, gehen Sie bitte auf die Website theconversation@hawaiipublicradio.org.
There's always a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and our Morning Edition host, Derek Malama, joins us at this point in the show every morning for a look at events going on in our community a little under the radar. Today, we're having a listening session, or there is a listening session scheduled, about Oahu's arts and culture needs.
Yeah, this is happening tomorrow. This is a good one. The Pacific Policy Research Center and the State Foundation on Culture and the Arts are collecting community input on how the SFCA should prioritize its time and resources over the next 5 years to help the arts grow in Hawaii. This session will be held in the multipurpose room at the Hawaii State Art Museum from 2 to 3:30, and refreshments will be provided. You can RSVP at the address on our website.
And there's free hula on Hawaii Island.
Yes. Hawaii Volcanoes National Park offers a free hula performance tomorrow night. And this is with the Halau Keolu Makani o Mauna Loa. It's from 6:30 to 8 p.m. in the Kilauea Visitor Center.
Sounds like a restful evening.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see the premiere of a Hawaiian music video tomorrow at Ward Village.
The Island Style Medley video stars John Cruz, Jack Johnson, Natalie Aikamau, Josh Tatofi, and others, along with over, 1,000 Hawaiian charter school youth, fitting all in this one video. The premiere is tomorrow at 6 in the Ward Village Courtyard. Amy Hanaili'i Palafunga and Taimane will perform live there, and it's free.
Derek, thank you very much. As always, Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our HawaiiPublicRadio.org website. And that's it for today. Up tomorrow, we'll talk about the viability of oil refining in Hawaii with Jim Yates, president of Power Hawaii Incorporated. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.